Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today's feature is about Japanese keshi toys, small rubber eraser figures that were popular in the 80s and 90s. There are many game-related ones, including a lot from Nintendo, so game preservationist Mr. Talita of Keshi Corner joins the podcast to chat all about this niche world of unique video game toys. In the game section, I give some final thoughts on the delightful Super Mario RPG remake, and then close out with a bit of news. But let's start with the feature on Keshi with Mr. Talita of Keshi Corner. Tokyo Game Life, only on the Tokyo Beat Podcast Network. Today's feature is about Keshi, short for Keshi Gomu, better known in English as eraser rubber. Now, you might be thinking, why are you talking about pencil erasers on a video game podcast? But these Keshi erasers have a very strong tie to video games, especially Nintendo titles. Joining me to chat all about it is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Mr. Talita from Mr. Talita's Keshi Corner. I am a game preservationist and archivist. As I just mentioned, I run the Keshi Corner Preservation Project.
Thanks for joining me. I explained it a bit at the top, but you can provide way more insight than I can. I think many people are fairly unfamiliar with the concept. So what is Keshi?
So these are eraser-like rubber figures. As you mentioned, Keshi means eraser and Gomu means rubber. And they usually portray characters and things from pop culture for the most part. And they were phenomenally popular, I'd say, from, let's say, the early 1980s throughout the 1990s. The history of the format, I would say, goes back a little bit further than that, perhaps at least to the 1950s with a company called Diner. They did some kind of animal figures and Disney character figures.
How did you first discover Keshi, and what about them intrigued you?
So for me, I think my entry point was the Legend of Zelda Keshi figures, the Legend of Zelda 1, the Famicom figures. In the early aughts, the early 2000s, I discovered them probably on eBay or something like that. I thought, what the heck is this? All these little off-model depictions of these characters and monsters from the first Zelda game. I was very intrigued in kind of discovering this whole realm of merchandise. One thing led to another, and I kind of discovered other Keshi figures and Keshi lines as time went on. And I've been to Japan a few times, and each time I go there, I end up at place called Nakano Broadway.
Yes.
And there's a whole bunch of different kind of nerd-oriented stores there, like little mini shops. But one of the larger chains is a company called, I think it's pronounced Mandarake. And they have a few different shops in this Nakano Broadway, each focusing on different aspects of kind of nerd culture. In one of their shops, it's all Keshi.
For me, I believe the first time I really encountered Keshi was the exact same place you said, when I went to Nakano Broadway here in Tokyo, which is a shopping mall with a ton of stores dedicated to retro items, especially toys. And there is one shop that really focuses on these Keshi figures, and they sell a lot of them in plastic bags, so you can buy many at a time. So when I first encountered them, I never even saw anything like this before, but the shop was really focused on selling these. And some of them are quite expensive. So do you know how people bought them back in the day? Were they blind box toys, or could you buy a set?
Yeah, they were predominantly distributed through gachapon machines, those gumball machines you drop 100 yen or 200 yen into. And you crack it open, and it's a surprise what's inside there. Or they were distributed through blind box, kind of toy candy combo things that I think go by the name Shokugan in Japan.
Yes.
It's like, it'll be, you can get any of these 12 different Mario figures blind at randomly, and then they stick some little gumball or junky piece of chocolate or something in there.
What do you think is the main appeal of Keshi compared to other toys?
I feel that it's the novelty of having this beloved figure, character, in the palm of your hand. They're usually about, these characters, these Keshi figures, are usually about an inch and a half tall. And so just the kind of the miniaturization of things. It's usually several different characters from a property will be in the set. And the allure of having to collect them all can really key into certain things for certain people. Like I said earlier, I'm a big Zelda fan. And so I have a large Zelda collection. I've even branched out into Zelda Keshi that I didn't think I would. Just as actually part of this Keshi Corner project, this scanning project, as I'm looking for new things to kind of interest people and present to people, I'll say, oh, well, I should probably pick up a couple more of these Ocarina of Time Keshi, or maybe some of these kind of obscure Zelda 2 Keshi.
Hmm.
And the Zelda 2 ones in particular, I'm not too fond of. They're very amateurly kind of sculpted, kind of crudely sculpted. Hmm. And I didn't think I would be interested in them, but just, again, in the process of doing this Keshi Corner project, I picked up one, and I picked up two, and then a third one, and, well, I might as well get the fourth and the fifth. Now I'm going for the full set. We'll see if that happens.
Yeah, like you said earlier, I think there is definitely a big collection aspect to it. When you have one, you want to have the rest of them. And I think size is also a big part of its appeal, because Gashapon figures are very popular because they're so small and you can put them anywhere. And in Japan, space is a premium. But Keshi, I can't really think of a smaller toy than Keshi. It feels like this is the minimum height you could possibly make of some of these characters.
Yeah, I agree with you totally. As the years have gone on, the prices have started to climb. So you can have 100 of them in a sock drawer and have that represent a couple $100 investment.
Definitely. So we really haven't talked about what they look like. We know they're rubber, but they're often made from these solid colors. Like one will be completely green or one will be completely blue. I think that's probably just easier to make. But I think that is part of its appeal. Are there multicolored Keshi, or are all of them just these monochromatic figures?
For the most part, they are this monochromatic eraser-like rubber material. A few sets were released that were painted. It wasn't super common because I do think it probably ate into the margins a bit. Mm. Although then it made for a more interesting specialty item, I suppose. I think there were some Ultraman figures that were painted. Those Zelda 2 figures I had mentioned, they would release a golden monochromatic, I believe a silver monochromatic, and then a very rare painted edition. But yeah, overall, it was usually a monochromatic. As time has gone on, as we've left the 90s, gone into the 2000s, I think the classic style of monochromatic eraser-like rubber Keshi has kind of fallen by the wayside. We've moved more into PVC materials. So you still do see something that one might refer to as Keshi, but it's not really the original form factor. It's more like this PVC, a little bit more sophisticated design. They even released them for games as recent as Breath of the Wild.
Oh.
And with these, they are full color. They'll have Link is wearing his green hat and his hair is kind of brownish blonde, and he's got his eyes painted in and everything. They're probably applied like a preform decal. They are much more sophisticated.
Let's go back to a bit of the history of the Keshi toys. You mentioned before their origins maybe in the 1950s, but I think in the 1970s and in the 80s and 90s, it started to become a lot more prominent. And a ton of notable franchises have their own Keshi figures, like Ultraman, Godzilla, and many video games like Zelda that we've mentioned. What other franchises are best associated with Keshi?
Well, one that was very prominent was the Kinnikuman. Kinnikuman started as a manga character, kind of like a wrestling character, and he fights all these other wrestling, kind of alien wrestler sort of characters. They made hundreds of unique figures in this series over the course of many years, and it even found success overseas in the West, in North America, and the like, under the brand name Muscle. Muscle is an acronym. Same toy, just different branding. So that one was very prolific. That one was made by Bandai.
Mm.
And then if you ever search for Keshi on eBay or Yahoo Auctions, you will see which ones were prolific. It's going to be stuff like Kinnikuman. It's Ultraman, Godzilla, SD Gundam, the super deformed Gundam, the little chibi miniaturized Gundams.
Mm.
You can get 100 of those for a penny a piece or whatever. Those were some of the ones that were quite popular. And then, of course, the Nintendo ones you see a lot.
Is there anything specifically about Kinnikuman that you think made it a popular Keshi toy?
Well, I knew that part of the reason it was able to come over to the West was just the intense popularity of professional wrestling at the time. The sky's the limit in terms of imagination of the figures. There's all sorts of crazy fighters. So really, the sky's the limit for what the IP can contain, right? You can keep making more and more and more characters. And I think that variety and just how many different figures they were able to create lent itself to being a very collectible.
So we've laid the groundwork, so let's get into the big ticket item, video game Keshis. What games or gaming franchises have had their own Keshi toys? You mentioned earlier Zelda 1 had Keshi toys, but what are some other ones?
Any large video games seem to have a Keshi figure at one point or another. Certainly Zelda, Mario, a lot of Mario, Mega Man, Bomberman, Puyo Puyo, and you know, countless others. Final Fantasy, Dragon Warrior, or Dragon Quest.
Yeah, there seems to be a ton of Nintendo figures based around Mario, Zelda. There's Pokemon ones, Kirby, Donkey Kong, and so on. And I really like the Zelda ones that you mentioned earlier because they have a ton of the enemies from the original game. And they're all the same color, so it does feel like, okay, this is one set, so it's easy to see how they're connected. Do you have a favorite singular Keshi toy or a favorite line of figures?
It's hard to say. I think I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but yeah, I just think that Zelda 1 set was what stole my heart initially, and I'm still in love with. It's just so endearing. They're so wonky looking, but definitely recognizable, and care and attention was paid to make them look like they're instruction manual artwork. So they are very true, but they have a very handcrafted feel. So that is very endearing and very fun for me as a fan of the series. Like I kind of alluded to earlier, in the process of doing my Keshi Corner project, I've been exposed to a whole bunch more Keshi than I was ever before the project. And in the process, I've certainly developed some new favorites. The Puyo Puyo ones, I think, are just adorable. Anytime you have these, I mean, those characters are so funny looking in the actual game, and they really are captured very well. It was a series put out by Kabaya, I believe, as a Shokugan, a blind box, several series, actually. And they really did the gamut of all the characters that show up. And those are really fun. The Super Mario World and Super Mario Brothers 3 figures are just a delight as well, because they have all the different enemies you encountered, Mario in all of his different costumes and whatnot. And so that's really fun to kind of collect and discover. A lot of these ones from the mid-90s, I guess some of those I just mentioned are actually from the late 80s, but as we got into the mid-90s, with the Puyo Puyo ones, for example, again, the sophistication of the sculpts got better and better. And so while the, let's say, the Mario 1 and the Zelda 1 figures from the mid-80s do feel very handcrafted and pretty off-model, as you get into the mid-90s, the characters are like very true to, say, the box art or the in-game art. There's a level of sophistication in material and sculpture and details that is really impressive. I think as we've gotten into kind of the modern era, 2000 and beyond, there's still a lot of joy to be found with these new figures. Again, they're more like PVC figures. But what I've found is that the manufacturing process is so sophisticated now that it's almost like the game companies can hand off that high poly model of the actual character to the sculptors or the manufacturers, whoever. And you get out something that looks, I mean, one-to-one identical to the character. And that's great. And that's admirable and wonderful. But you do lose some of that novelty of something that was crafted by hand and is maybe a little bit off model, just slightly. It's a little bit endearing for that.
I guess a hot topic recently, of course, is Super Mario RPG. And I've noticed on Keshi Corner, you've been uploading the Super Mario RPG Keshi toys. Can you delve more into these toys?
Certainly. Again, these were made by Bandai. I think Bandai was probably the most prolific of the companies that made Keshi in, like, let's say the 90s and 80s. The Super Mario RPG ones were released in two sets. They had one set of 20-some figures, I want to say like 21, 22 figures that were released in a blind box that had just the figures and maybe like a little ID card for the character, some sort of artwork. And then they separately, Bandai released a separate run of fewer, I want to say maybe it's more like 10 characters for this, but they were paired with a playset, a little miniaturized playset. The game world in Mario RPG is separated into like five different zones. And so they released these five different areas, this little miniaturized place that's that Takeshi could kind of stand on and play in. I think each blind box came with a set piece and then two Takeshi figures. And they are kind of highly sought after, as is most Mario RPG merch, just because Solo was made and it proved to be such kind of a cult hit, the Super Nintendo original, that in the years that followed, people were scrambling like mad to try to gobble these things up. So what I'm getting at is that even the individual Takeshi figures, playsets standing, the individual figures can fetch a price. So it was really gratifying when I was able to kind of snipe a deal here and there over the years and assemble a full set of the Mario RPG figures. I do not have a full set of playsets. People who have those know what they have and they list them for $1,500 or something.
Whoa.
It's never going to happen. You know?
Let's talk about your Takeshi preservation project, Takeshi Corner. What's the goal of the project and how did it come about in the first place?
Yeah, so Takeshi Corner is my attempt to capture, preserve the Takeshi experience, this aspect of the games that is potentially overlooked a little bit. When we talk about game preservation and the game preservation scene, these days it's bigger than ever. A lot more people are aware of the importance of preserving our history, and a lot more people are active participants in this endeavor. And that has allowed us an opportunity to kind of widen the aperture beyond just preserving the games themselves. Everyone's dumping ROMs and finding prototypes in the attics and stuff like that these days, which is wonderful. But now we can, like I said, open that aperture and look at some of the other aspects of the video game industry and the video game experience. Ephemeral things like news articles, magazines, advertisements, and certainly what I'm choosing to focus on, which is toys and merchandise. Those are all a part of that story, right? That was part of the experience of consuming, so to speak, these games in their contemporary period. And I just think it's really cool that 3D scanning technology has advanced to the point that's starting to become more and more feasible for people to preserve things like this. I myself use a dental scanner. It's meant to scan, you know, teeth and dentures and that sort of thing to, you know, create accurate models of inside someone's mouth, I suppose. But I found that type of scanner was just perfect for this application of scanning these 1-inch tall, monochromatic, rubberized figures, kind of toothy or gummy, just enough that it was perfect for this type of scanner. Takeshi Corner is a Twitter account. I also do a YouTube account, which I've been neglecting, I'm sorry to say. And then everything I scan goes up on archive.org. And every day, I post a new 3D scan of a Takeshi figure. This happens every weekday, a new one will be posted. And I try to provide them in STL format, and anyone can download it. It's completely free. And really just the hope is that this allows more people to discover these really wonderful toys from vintage video gaming yesteryear. I think people are discovering the Super Mario RPG, Takeshi, for example. I chose to really do kind of a blitz of uploading these around the launch of the remake, on a few people kind of reaching out and being kind of surprised by these toys and interested in learning more. Basically, the goal of this project is to preserve the artifacts and make them accessible.
So how do you go about scanning one of these items and uploading it to archive.org? For example, walk me through, say, getting Geno uploaded.
First, you have to get a hold of the Takeshi figure, which is an ordeal in itself. Sometimes, as I mentioned, a few of these are a little bit more rare and hard to get. But anyway, you say you've got the figure. You have the figure. What I do is I mount it to my dental scanner. It's a structured light scanner, which is a type of scanner that kind of cascades specific patterns of light across the subject. And two cameras look at those patterns and kind of observe how the expected pattern is distorted and use that information to construct points in space. And then from there, once you have enough points in space, you can actually reconstruct the polygonal structure. You stick the Takeshi figure to this platter and the scanner rotates it this way and that way and looks at it from all these different angles. And usually one scan is not enough because, for example, your Keshi figure, he's standing on the platter. He has to be scanned twice for like his top-down kind of view, and then again, flip him upside down so the scanner can see his feet. That's the most kind of naive or optimistic type of scan. If you're really lucky, that will be enough. You'll have gotten every facet of the figure. More often than not, the character has some stubborn little overhanging element or a little cavity of some kind that's hard for two cameras to see at any given time, which is really what has to happen for that point, that 3D point, to be triangulated in 3D space. So it can be an ordeal, 3, 4, 5 scans, putting the figure in different compositions and orientations to try to get a complete picture of the figure. The software associated with the scanner will then take all these different scans and kind of composite them together. So you have one, in the end, you have one complete scan. I think that is the general process. It spits out an STL file or an OBJ file, one of those two. Those are very common 3D formats. I have some scripts I've written that will parse through all the different Keshi I've scanned for that day and render out a preview image and write up a archive.org article for me and kind of like upload it all for me. I also used to produce little videos, like 4-minute videos of the scanning process of each of these figures, but that was very tedious to do. I found I just cannot produce anything fast enough to keep the upload cadence where I wanted it to be. I suppose that's the whole process. Occasionally you end up with a figure that is very stubborn and very difficult to scan. This whole scanning process really relies on the idea that the figure is not going to move in relation to itself. Like you can rotate it and do these different scans, but it can't bend, it can't deform, or the foot can't be in a different position in this scan than it was in that one, because then it just doesn't know how to reconcile that. So things have to be perfectly rigid and perfectly consistent from one scan to the next. So if you have a figure with kind of thin limbs or any sort of a rope or a whip or a thin sword, those things tend to be subject to gravity at the very least, or maybe bend a little as you're securing it to the platter for scanning. And so there are challenges, there's technical challenges associated with that that are too tedious and boring for me to go into, but suffice to say, I have spent on a good day 15 to 20 minutes on a single scan. On a bad day with one of these problem scans, it can take up to like 2 hours.
Wow. Yeah, I did not expect a dental scanner to enter our conversation today, but I'm very happy that people are using these like out-of-the-box items to preserve video game history. And you've uploaded the 3D scan figures on archive.org. So how can people use them?
There's all sorts of applications. The most obvious one is 3D printing, right? But you can do more than just print them in their original form factor. Maybe you can scale it up. Like I said, Keshi are maybe an inch and a half tall in general. Maybe you want something that is larger, 3 inches tall, 4 inches tall. You know, while the amount of detail is not going to miraculously increase, you can push it a little bit and get something that's taller than the original genuine article, which might be more satisfying. You could also, let's say you own a Keshi that you don't really want to handle too much. Maybe it's rare or fragile or something like that, but you would really love to be able to handle it more. You want to paint it, for example. You could print a 3D printed version of the Keshi now and then have at it, paint it however you like, and know that the original item is safe. I've also done some experiments myself where I have animated Keshi in a 3D program, but a 3D skeleton inside them and animate little simple motions, which is pretty fun and exciting. Sometimes very silly. I've also done things where I've digitally painted them. Instead of printing it out and physically painting it, I will paint it in the computer just to see, well, if it were a painted figure, if it wasn't this monochromatic rubber, what would it look like? And that is really exciting to do as well. I've put a couple videos up. If you're interested, you can go on, look for Keshi Corner on YouTube or even sometimes on my Twitter account.
Are there any Keshi figures that you're hunting for or some that you think might be difficult to find and preserve?
Yeah, I still would love to get a full set of the Zelda 2 figures. A company called Lot, released a bunch of different Nintendo properties in a series. And the Zelda 2 ones were released in that form factor, and they came with accessories. And to find just one of the figures without the accessories, just the figure on its own, can be difficult. To find it with the accessories, you know, is finding a unicorn. And people who have these know what they have, so they're listing it for $500 or more. So it would be really wonderful to stumble upon that in Nakano Broadway sometime, but those people know what they have as well. So
yeah,
probably not going to happen. I'm actually missing one or two Mario RPG figures. I mentioned that there were like 20 some odd figures and then another maybe 10 for this playset version. I have all of the loose character only ones, and I have most of the characters from the playset. The only two I don't have is Peach and the Piranha Plant. I've seen them listed places, but they're always like $20-$30, and I just can't bring myself to pay that much. But yeah, I think those are the ones I'm mostly looking for. In the process of doing this Keshi Corner project, a lot of things that I had always hoped to collect, I've been able to. I've had an excuse to do so. So let's say if I wanted to get all the Super Mario Brothers 3 figures, I've gotten them all now, and I've been scanning them all. And so you too at home can have all the Super Mario Brothers 3 figures soon.
Awesome. Is there any modern franchise or game that you think would be perfect for Keshi?
That's a great question. I would love to see more of these figures for our favorite franchises. I think these days it's only like the top tier series that get these. You'll see new figures for Mario or for Zelda. I just don't feel like we see it too much beyond that. I think it would be fun to just have a throwback to these sorts of products in general, I think is what I'm trying to say. For modern games, something that's hand sculpted would be very cool. And just with all the inaccuracies or wonkiness that comes with that, I think it would be a breath of fresh air.
I think the perfect franchise for Keshi, of course, is Pikmin. You could market as the Pikmin or the actual size of the actual Keshi.
I love it. I'm glad you mentioned that. That's a great idea. Yeah.
All right. So Nintendo, if you're listening, get on that right now. You'll have at least two sales. Well, we've hit on all the important, or at least all the cool parts of the world of Keshi toys and their links to video games. So Mr. Toledo, before I let you go, where can people find you?
Right. So if you're interested in the Keshi Corner project, you can find me at twitter.com/KeshiCorner. If you're interested in game preservation in general, you can find me at twitter.com/MrToledo, MrTaLida. I'm also on the YouTubes occasionally, as I mentioned. Just look for Mr. Toledo or Keshi Corner. And I'm around. You'll see me on various social medias.
Great. And listeners, the links to everything are in the podcast description, so check it out. Mr. Toledo of Keshi Corner, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a brief ad break.
We're the Tokyo Fresh Podcast.
I'm David.
I'm Jordan.
We're a comedy lifestyle podcast diving into the weird and interesting side of Japan.
We often share stories about our lives in Japan, you know, and how you can avoid making the same mistakes.
So if you want to take advice from two idiots who have been living here far too long, check out the Tokyo Fresh Podcast.
Only on the Tokyo Beat Network.
Last episode, I talked a bit about Super Mario RPG, the 2023 Arte Piazza-developed remake of the 1996 SNES game. I was only about 90 minutes in, but now I've rolled credits and even went out of my way to beat Kulex. If you know, you know. So I want to share some final thoughts on the Mario RPG game that started it all and technically launched two other completely different franchises. How many other spinoffs can say they launched even more spinoffs? Like I said in the last episode, I don't have any real nostalgia for the game. I didn't play it upon release, and when I finally got my hands on the title via my good friend Mr. ZSNES, I only played maybe about an hour or so. It's mostly a completely new experience for me. And I'm happy to report that I loved the game. It was a delightful adventure from start to finish. Though I don't have nostalgia for this specific game, I did get hit pretty hard with nostalgia for this type of game and the classic era of JRPGs. A lot of people have said that the game is pretty simple and straightforward, baby's first RPG, and yeah, it is in many ways. This would totally be an excellent RPG to introduce to a kid who isn't familiar with the genre. The game is quite easy, but thankfully it's not brain dead. You still need to be aware of what you're doing in battles, and when you're exploring, it's very easy to miss stuff if you're not paying attention. I've never been one to criticize an easy game as long as the mechanics are fun. And here, they are fun. Timing attacks in battles, you would think it would get old, but it really doesn't. It's so satisfying to have the feedback of nailing the timing. And in this remake, they added AoE attacks to the perfect timing, which, yes, makes the game even easier technically, but isn't getting rewarded with a bonus AoE attack fun? I think so. I want that splash damage. The game is very clever in mixing it up via the weapon progression. Your first weapon for Mario makes him punch enemies, but the next one is a hammer, which has a completely different timing. And then you also get a shell, which also has different timing. All characters kind of cycle through these different weapons with new timing mechanics, which helps battle stay fun all the way to the end. Plus, there are triple attacks where you can do a super move. There's fun items to use, like one that summons Yoshi. Each character has a very specific role in the battle thanks to their unique special attacks. I just never got bored of doing battles. Especially since it has one of the best victory fanfares I've ever heard. I listened to both the original one and the new orchestrated version, and the new one is just miles above. And outside of the battles, everything else about the game works. The original dev team really nailed the concept of a Mario RPG, blending in the action-oriented gameplay of the platformers with elements people love from JRPGs. We take it for granted now because we have, what, half a dozen Mario RPGs? But it's impressive that they got it right the first go-around. And because this game is closer to a traditional JRPG than Paper Mario or Mario and Luigi, it still feels rather distinct, even if you played those other games. I mean, a three-member party? I wouldn't mind going back to that, honestly. The game has everything I love about JRPGs. A fun battle system that doesn't get boring, unique towns with their own story and atmosphere. It really draws from Dragon Quest, where every town is like its own little episode of an anime. But I think this game does an even better job of tying the town's unique story in with the larger one. In Dragon Quest, it often does feel like, okay, a new town, back to square one, I gotta meet like five new people, and then listen to them prattle on until I go to the boss and then rinse and repeat. The second you enter a town in Super Mario RPG, you get its deal. You understand that the Mushroom Kingdom is prosperous. You know Moleville is a big mining hub. Seaside Town immediately catches your attention with these strange toads you encounter. There's also a town that's just a hotspot for weddings. These are the types of places I want to visit in a JRPG. And the game is also filled with a lot of memorable characters. Mallow is endearing. Geno, I guess he's supposed to be cool, even though he doesn't do a whole lot. Bowser is hilarious as always. You meet weirdos like Booster and Valentina. Everyone has a purpose in the story, or at the very least, they're entertaining. The game also has plenty of side quests, secrets, and minigames. It's crazy to think about how much work they must have put into some of these minigames that most people would encounter only once or so, or maybe even not encounter at all. There's a behind-the-back minecart race. There's a guy who sells a box to collect beetles, and then you race up a mountain collecting them. There's a whole island filled with Yoshis where you can race them and see the legendary Fat Yoshi. There's also a secret casino filled with card games, and a lot of these secret things are hidden pretty well. You'll definitely need to crack open a guide for some. But part of the fun of JRPGs is being amazed at just how much fun stuff the game is hiding from you, and when you do find it, you get that sense of satisfaction. You feel like you are getting one up on the game when you get that secret weapon for Mario after uncovering a secret. Super Mario RPG is also filled with dungeons and puzzles, something a lot of JRPGs have stripped out of their games for the sake of streamlining or not stressing out the player. But when I play a JRPG, I want to explore a dungeon and manage my inventory before I fight a big boss. I want to do some weird block-pushing puzzle, so the game mechanics feel way grander than just selecting things from a menu. Now, the dungeons in Super Mario RPG aren't labyrinthian by any means, but they all feel different. I really love Booster's Tower. I don't think I've ever explored a big wooden tower with a, I guess, a board game aesthetic. It's so strangely designed that you can't help but remember it. And in that dungeon, if you go to a secret spot, you suddenly turn into 8-bit Mario for absolutely no reason. I love all the for absolutely no reason moments in the game, like finding Samus resting in a bed or buying a Game Boy off a toad. The game is overflowing with creativity and ambition, despite it stemming from Square wanting to create a simple RPG that would appeal to a wider audience. Even though they simplified a lot of elements of the genre, that doesn't mean they just took them out of the game. Instead, they adapted these classic JRPG ideas into new ones. And there's a bunch of fun one-off ideas as well, like having to ride a Yoshi to talk to other Yoshi. They could have just had you talk to Yoshis, but the devs went the extra mile to make it feel more authentic and memorable. The game is fairly short for a JRPG. I rolled credits after about 13 hours, and after doing some of the side quests and minigames and beating Kulex, I hit around 15 hours. I didn't 100% the game. There are more boss battles I can participate in, but I imagine most people will hit the 15-ish hour mark at most. Even though it is short, I felt like the game was very well paced. I didn't feel like there was a shortage of towns or boss fights. Instead, I was impressed by just how much they packed into the game. There's what, hundreds of unique enemies? A half dozen towns? It's got a bunch of field exploration areas and hidden sections that aren't on the map until you find them. JRPGs now are like a four-letter word for busy people, or at least people who want to play a game for 20 hours and then move on to the next one. I've been playing Octopath Traveler 2. My play count for that game is around 30-ish hours, and yeah, I'm not done with the game at all. Maybe not even halfway. Do JRPGs need to return to the 15 to 20 hour sweet spot? I think the fear is that the adventure won't seem that grand, and there won't be a feeling of your characters progressing if the game is that short. But I feel Super Mario RPG disproves that. I felt all my characters getting stronger, I visited a ton of cool places, and the story, while basic, hey, it had a satisfying conclusion, and it was filled with a lot of fun moments. Isn't that what we want from a JRPG? I honestly wouldn't mind more from the game, let's say an extra 5 hours worth of content, whether it means more towns or dungeons or whatever, but I do think the devs felt like maybe the straightforward mechanics of the game had a limit and wanted to get out of there in 10 to 15 hours. I don't have any real major criticisms about the game. Yes, the jumping mechanics can be a little frustrating at times. That's just the nature of it being isometric, where you need to space your jumps, but if you miss a jump, just try again. It's not like the game takes half your money or half your health. I was a bit bummed by the absence of Luigi. There's a reference to him, and he has a very small cameo at the end, but it did feel weird to play a Mario RPG with zero Luigi. I highly doubt that would ever happen again. And the game in general is filled with this-will-never-happen-again decisions. There's a ton of enemies that never appear in any other Mario games, and some that look like a hybrid of the cutesy wonder of Mario and the fantasy roots of Dragon Quest. Their take on the bad guys, the Smithy Gang, is an interesting angle since they are all weapons. Is this some sort of meta-commentary on Mario not needing weapons? Or pushing against the concept of a JRPG needing your typical fantasy armory like swords and spears? I suppose Square owns all the original characters, which is why we haven't seen them, but I would love to see them appear in more games. Can't they just do like a handshake deal? No one is making money off of Boshi, when they should be bringing in millions of dollars each year through Boshi merch alone. Oh, and I did forget to mention that the soundtrack is probably the best I've heard all year. Okay, maybe I would put Zelda above it, but this music in the game is absolutely incredible. Podcast? Who needs them when the tracks are this good? But Super Mario RPG, great game, and I'm glad I got to check it off my list of Nintendo games I've missed. If you want a no-nonsense JRPG that harkens back to what made the genre great in the 90s, this is it. Is it as good as Paper Mario? Objectively, I think not, but I could understand people playing this game first and then thinking Paper Mario wasn't quite as fresh. For me, it's the opposite, since I played Paper Mario first, then realized it was the perfect video game, and now I compare everything to it. The game is selling quite well, and if the Thousand Year Door remaster makes waves, hey, we could be seeing more Mario RPGs sooner than later. Okay, that's it for games, now for the news. Some news, Nintendo Live 2024. Want to go to it? Well, you better sign up now because they are taking applications to attend until December 6th. If you're unfamiliar with the event, it's not like Tokyo Game Show. It's really a family-focused event with Nintendo-themed activities, tournaments to watch, and at night there are live concerts. Last year had Deep Cut from Splatoon 3, and this year they return, along with an orchestrated Zelda concert. Maybe the biggest piece of news is that there is a demo station for Princess Peach Showtime. Now, the event is in late January, and the game comes out in February, so this means attendees get their hands on the game before anyone else. This is similar to Wonder being available at the US Nintendo Live event in September. At the Japanese events, they've stressed that this is not a place for new game announcements or showing off unreleased games, but they are dipping their toes into that water a bit with these demo stations. Am I going? Maybe. While they aren't using the word lottery or chusen in Japanese, they do say that you will be selected, which sounds an awful lot like a lottery. If I can't go, it's not the end of the world since I can at least hopefully find a guest for the podcast who did attend, and then I can live vicariously through them. Ironically, I didn't go to Nintendo Live last year because it was the exact same weekend I went to Super Nintendo World. I would definitely choose that over Live any day, though. Pokemon centers in Japan now have Hyper Beam-themed merch. This includes merch featuring art of Pokemon using the iconic super move Hyper Beam, or Hakai Kousen, as it's known in Japanese. This translates to Destruction Beam, so they did soften it a bit for the localization. Dragonite, Snorlax, Porygon, Gyarados, Aerodactyl, and Tauros are featured, which I would say are fairly iconic Hyper Beam users. Who's the most iconic one, though? I think a lot of people slapped Hyper Beam onto Mewtwo back in the day, just because, well, he's the strongest. The art looks really nice, it has kind of a graffiti aesthetic, and the merch has a lot of black apparel with the art and the word Hyper Beam slapped on it, so it's going for a bit more of an older audience. The coolest piece of merch is definitely the towels, which has the art on one side, and then the towel is the actual beam, ending with a big pixelated circle like in the original game. I haven't made my way out to the Pokemon Center since it was released, but I could always use more towels. And speaking of new merch, Sanae has a ton of new plushies coming next year. Elephant Mario plushie, Glow Pikmin plushie, and also Splat Bomb plushies. Plushies of the Koroks with the backpacks. As usual, the Sanae plushies all look fantastic, and the Korok plushies, that's definitely going to be a big, big seller. Expect people to torture the Koroks, but this time in real life. GoldenEye and Jet Force Gemini are now on Nintendo Switch Online in Japan. What took so long for GoldenEye? Well, it and Jet Force Gemini, called Star Twins in Japan, are rated 0Z, aka 18+. Nintendo has released a special Nintendo 64 18+ NSO app in Japan to house these two fiendish titles. Will there be more added? I'm never really familiar with the 0Z ratings for other Nintendo 64 games. I'm sure they exist, but will they appear on the Nintendo Switch platform? I would think GoldenEye is the most popular 0Z game. Perfect Dark, that is likely rated 0Z as well, so if they do add Perfect Dark to NSO, which would be amazing, I can see it being on that app as well. And last tiny bit of news, Splatoon 3 will have Frosty Fest for the first time ever in this upcoming chill season. Like Splatoon, the hub is decorated, but this time with a lot of Christmassy and winter decorations. Also, Shiver, Fry, Big Man have really fantastic elaborate costumes, especially Big Man, who is sporting a tuxedo. And don't forget to check the news section for some free Splatoon gear. Now, while the event is mostly just a skin, the atmosphere is really unparalleled. It looks fantastic, and I always look forward to them. Will there be even more events next year? How about a spring event? Maybe Hanami for April? We'll see. All right, let's wrap it up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I'm on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on December 17th. It'll be a Game of the Year episode, so get hyped. See you next time. Matane.